Word of mouth.
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 Well, Duff with.
Coming up on Word of Mouth, lower prices, more hate. A new study suggests a correlation between big box stores and the presence of hate groups. And an internet phenomenon turns Twitter humor and hilarious blog posts into a scathingly funny memoir.
We grew up pretty poor, although I have to say that I really just thought, well, we don't need running water that won't kill you when you swallow it. That's not something you need. That's a luxury that you get when you become a millionaire.
We'll also talk to a man who claims to be the healthiest person on the planet. A new book follows A.J. Jacobs' attempt at every exercise, diet, and health claim in his quest for bodily perfection.
If you take a sip of a sports drink and then spit it out, that will give you a boost of energy.
I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of mouth shapes up new ideas after the news.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
For word of mouth.
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 Well, Duff, with.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up, take a kid to prison day. A new summer camp run by the New Hampshire Department of Corrections combines arts, crafts, and FaceTime for incarcerated fathers and their kids. And the internet phenomenon known as the Blogess sets her much-memed voice to writing an incredulously funny memoir. But first, lower prices, more extreme. A new joint study among economists shows significant correlation between the number of big box stores, specifically Walmart, and the number of hate groups in a region. Dr. Stefan Getz is director of the Northeast Regional Center for Rural Development and professor of agricultural and regional economics at Penn State. He's also lead author of the study, Social Capital, Religion, Walmart, and Hate Groups in America, which was published by Social Science Quarterly earlier this month. Dr. Getz, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
How did you discover this correlation between Walmart and hate groups? What kind of data were you looking for?
Well, we started out looking at some possible factors that might account for the existence of hate groups in different counties across the United States. And the traditional variables one would look at are things like divorce rates, unemployment rate, also something called social capital, all of which could contribute to the formation of these groups. And at the end, we decided to also look at whether the big box stores might have an effect. And lo and behold, there was the remaining residual variation in the data that did indeed bear that out, that there was a relationship.
Is the correlation specific to Walmart, or can other big box stores stand in?
No, we think it's big box stores as a group that are sort of having these effects in communities that are associated with more hate groups. So it's really not just Walmart, but Walmart is studied the most because it's present in more counties than the other stores, and the data are also easier to get for that particular store.
You mentioned some of the things that you and your colleagues were looking at. Do you have some theories about the connections between Walmarts and hate groups?
Yes, and just to be very clear, as you pointed out, it is sort of a correlation and association. We're not saying there's any causation here.
Mm-hmm.
There may be other variables that are explaining the existence of both the chain and the hate groups that we're not able to measure in our study. But we do outline three plausible explanations as to why we are finding this result. One is sort of the decline of the small-scale retail sector in communities that inevitably occurs when Walmart comes to town. So we think that with those folks, as those businesses shut down, we also lose some civic capacity, some leadership capacity in these communities. And as a result, we see this emergence, the possible emergence of hate groups.
You also cite religious priming. What does that mean?
Yes, this is something that we weren't familiar with, but that came up during the review process. And it's the fact that certain words, such as working hard, saving money, etc., have been shown in other studies to trigger racist thought in experimental settings. So they have a control group and a non-control group, and they find out that these words prompt certain kinds of hatred or maldisposition towards certain ethnic groups or race groups. So we think that the fact that Walmart innocently uses words like live better, save more, inadvertently has this side effect of contributing to hate group formation.
This story, of course, had been picked up by a lot of bloggers and publications. Should we be careful not to read too much into this study? Or what can the result be? Is Walmart supposed to take action?
I don't think Walmart is deliberately doing this, and so I don't think there's any role for Walmart to play in this. I think it's something we need to be aware of, that lower prices do have other unintended potential consequences within these counties, some indirect effects that may not be obvious on the surface, and we might try to deal with those more directly, such as through working with civic groups and so forth, making perhaps religious leaders aware of the influence that their words have on the congregations, potentially. But Walmart's not doing this on purpose, and therefore I really don't see a role for them to step forward and to change things they're doing.
Well, Dr. Stefan Getz, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Stefan Getz, director of the Northeast Regional Center for Rural Development and professor of agriculture and regional economics at Pennsylvania State University. You can find more coverage of his study, Social Capital, Religion, Walmart, and Hate Groups in America, at wordofmouthradio.org. Among the many rites of a New England spring is the annual hustle to get kids signed up for summer camp. This year, inmates in the New Hampshire prison system are joining the fray. As NHBR's Dan Gorenstein reports, the Department of Corrections is offering its first ever summer camp for the children of incarcerated fathers.
There's a saying when you're in prison. After 3 years, people start to drop off.
You start to lose friends. You start to lose letters. You start to lose contacts.
That's 44-year-old Michael Cerisi, who understands that loss. He served 4 years so far, with as many as 8 more to go.
And it's only with your close family that you really maintain any kind of contact. And even then, sometimes they tend to fall off.
Cerisi knows about that, too. When he first arrived at the Concord Men's Prison, his twin boys used to visit every 2 weeks. Then it was once a month. Now they're 9, and he hasn't seen them in 4 months. Cerisi says when they do come, he peppers them with questions, trying to get to know them.
I want to know their hobbies, their interests, what's going on. You know, are you starting to like girls? You know, what friends do you have? You know, who's coming around? Anything, like, intimate.
That kind of intimacy is hard to come by in prison, especially in the Concord Men's Prison visiting room.
There's, you know, 100 or so other people and 50 or so other kids, and kids just want to play with other kids. They say, hi, Dad, I love you, and big hugs, but then they go and play.
That's Christina Toth, who runs the Family Connection Center for the New Hampshire Department of Corrections. She says for the past 13 years, the department has worked to build relationships between incarcerated parents and their children. Toth says corrections officials have embraced running a summer camp to the point where wardens will transfer inmates from Berlin to Concord if necessary.
Everyone I've agreed with, any of the fathers in Berlin that are part of our program, you know, could they be moved down for a week? Sure, no problem. It's amazing.
This August, as many as 20 kids will spend 12 days at Camp Spalding in Penacook, a few miles from the prison. Most of that time will be spent doing campy things, arts and crafts, canoeing, ropes courses. But for 2 days, Toth says kids will be with their dads in a totally different way.
They're talking and they're hugging and they're eating together and they're doing normal everyday activities together. What I hope those children get is the knowledge that they're loved.
This summer camp idea comes out of the Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit Hope House. Hope House has run 27 camps across 3 states. The group's director, Carol Fennelly, thinks the program works because the intense time together forces dads to ask themselves probing questions.
What is my legacy going to be in this world? What am I going to leave behind? These guys are behind bars. They don't have the ability to create that legacy. All they have is their kids. And I think that for them, that becomes the transcendent thing. And are they going to leave a positive legacy in that child or a negative legacy in that child?
Fennelly says she believes that self-examination leads to transformation.
I know we've got some bad guys in there who've done some bad things. I'm not delusional about who they were. But in prison with their children, they're just dads.
The more these inmates think of themselves as dads, the New Hampshire Department of Corrections believes, the better. Research suggests a good bond helps keep the parent from returning to prison and helps make sure the kid never winds up there. Concord inmate Michael Cerisi says the hope of getting his kids to camp this August is keeping him on the straight and narrow. Cerisi says he doesn't want to blow this chance.
On the visitor schedule, if you break it down, I only get to see them 2 days out of the year by the hours that I get to see them, which is absolutely nothing. So to have an extra 2 days of like full contact like means the world to me.
Only a tiny fraction of the some 800 fathers in the New Hampshire prison system will be directly involved in this program. But this whole concept, camp for kids of incarcerated dads, is so popular, several inmates are making the rounds raising money for scholarships. They think they can raise enough among themselves that they'll be able to help send a few kids to camp. For NHPR News, I'm Dan Gorenstein.
And NHPR senior reporter Dan Gorenstein is in the studio to follow up on that story. Dan, first of all, now senior reporter, congratulations.
Thanks very much, Virginia.
It's great to have you
here.
Nice
to be here.
And terrific job on the story. So how does this work? Will inmates actually be staying at summer camp, at sleepaway camp?
Not in this program, Virginia, no. What's going to happen? There are going to be a couple of field trips. You know, the kids are going to be at camp right near the prison, 5-10 miles from the prison. And two of the 12 days they'll be at camp will actually be spent at the Concord Men's Prison at the campus. The program is really sort of an arts and crafts based program, a curriculum. And, you know, it actually starts out in this cute way where you've got the inmates that are participating are going to be putting on some sort of skit for the kids. And one, that's just obviously an icebreaker. But interestingly, talking to the woman from Washington, D.C., who conceived of this idea, she said in some way, really, what the point of that skit is for the inmates themselves to get to know each other and trust each other and build kind of rapport amongst each other as they kind of meet the kids with this same face. And so the kids are going to be there, I don't know, 8 o'clock in the morning until 2 o'clock in the afternoon. They'll eat breakfast and lunch there with their dads. So the inmates are not going to camp.
They won't be going to camp. But in some way, they're doing those camp-like things, yes. Right? The icebreakers. And I wonder, so much about prison life must be about the dynamic between the prisoners and, you know, we hear of anyway, those dramatized vendettas or violence. Is there any concern about issues of security for the kids themselves? I mean, what's the DOC doing about that?
Well, one thing that I asked Christina Toth, who's going to be sort of running this up for the Department of Corrections, and what she said is that pretty much any inmate is eligible except for inmates who've committed any sort of sex crimes against children. Those are the only folks that are not eligible to participate in this program. That seemingly makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. There will be security on hand or what have you, but I think this program's been up and running for years, over a decade, even in a maximum security prison down in Maryland. People feel pretty comfortable that this is a fairly safe space for kids and their fathers.
I noticed you did never say why Michael Cerisi was in prison.
No, I didn't. He committed robbery. And the reason I didn't is because something that they talk about is, as much as they can, the Department of Corrections wants these guys to think of themselves as fathers first, not as inmates, not as prisoners, not as convicts, because that's going to help build the relationship, the bond between child and parent.
Has Michael found out yet if his son was chosen for camp?
He has not found out yet. That we're going to find out more. Hopefully I'll be doing a story this summer and that we'll be able to answer that question.
Yeah, that's interesting. You're thinking of actually going.
Oh, I'd love to.
Oh. NHPR senior reporter Dan Gorenstein, thanks so much.
Thank you, Virginia.
You'll find a link to his story in the New Hampshire Department of Corrections first ever summer camp for children of inmates. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. And we will be listening as Dan follows up on the story. Now up next, he's middle-aged, he's all-weather, and he's committed. After 2 years of trying out every diet, workout, and health fad he could uncover, A.J. Jacob says he's the healthiest person on the planet. He'll get a chance to prove it when word of mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. A.J. Jacobs is serious about self-improvement. The experiential journalist and Esquire editor-at-large spent a year reading the Encyclopedia Britannica for his book, The Know-It-All. The Year of Living Biblically was his memoir of abiding by every single rule in the Bible for 1 year. After mind and spirit, A.J. turned to body. Inspired by an app that projected what he'd look like at age 70, A.J. Jacobs again turned guinea pig and spent 2 years trying every diet, workout, health fad, and aspect of the body in a quest for bodily perfection. His new book is called Drop Dead Healthy, and A.J. Jacobs, who now says he's the healthiest person on the planet, joins us from Miami. Hi, A.J.
Hello, Virginia. Thanks for having me.
Well, we took a look at this Our Face. That's the app that ages your photograph. And we decided it is the cruelest app ever invented.
Yeah, you have to use it with caution. But it can be used for good because studies show that the more you think about your future self, the more you're aware of your future self, the better, you're smarter your decisions are going to be in the present. So that's what I used it for. I put a picture of myself at age 70 above my desk, and if I'm feeling like eating some ho-hos or not working out, I'll look at that and I'll be, you know, I got to treat this guy with respect, just like I treat my wife and my kids and my friends with respect.
Above your desk or your treadmill, we understand you wrote this book on a treadmill.
Excellent point. Yes, I did. anytime you can walk around, even just getting up from your desk once an hour is a huge improvement. And I took it to the extreme. So I bought a treadmill.
Which you do.
And that's my job. And I put my laptop on top of the treadmill and I wrote the book. It took me about 1,200 miles. It actually helped me be more productive, helped me focus. And I am not coordinated. So if I can do it, I think anyone can.
Well, you started the project tackling your own weight. Now, what were a few of the diets that you did test and how'd they stack up for you?
I tested out all sorts of diets. So I did raw food, vegan diet. I did the paleo diet, which is the caveman diet, mm-hmm. where you eat a lot of meat. And in the end, I think the evidence does support a mostly plant diet with some protein. I think that there's a lot of disagreement in the nutrition world, but the one thing everyone agrees on is that refined carbs like white bread, white rice, white flour, that is terrible for you.
You know, Americans, of course, love the quick fix. They have difficulty with lifestyle changes unless backed into a corner. How about you? What was your motivation to change? Now, you had a book advance to live up to. and then, of course, you had that photograph of yourself at 70. What made it work for you?
Well, you're right. That's a huge part of trying to be healthy. And by the way, I don't consider myself the healthiest person alive because as soon as I say that, I'm going to get rickets or some horrible disease. But I do consider myself a lot healthier than I used to be. And one of the big challenges is how do you motivate yourself? How do you get good habits, healthy habits? One of the things I found most effective was self-tracking. Anytime, the studies show that anytime you keep track of your numbers, it inspires you to act in a healthier way. And that can be anything from just keeping a food journal, quantifying what you eat. I bought a pedometer, and that was a life changer because my goal was 10,000 steps a day, which is what I think the American Heart Association recommends. And it turned it into a game. I wanted to get to that 10,000. And it was so motivating. I still use it. So there are ways to do that. There are tricks to help you be healthier.
Well, you say you still use it, but I remember reading that you can't remember many of the factoids from your mental self-improvement program, reading the Encyclopedia Britannica. So what makes you think this one is going to stick?
Well, first of all, I will say I read the Encyclopedia as my first book, and I have forgotten 98% of what was in the Encyclopedia, but 2% is still in there.
Still good for 2%, party tricks.
Yeah, exactly. But 2% of the encyclopedia, that's a lot better off than I used to be. I mean, that is a big book. That's still a lot of information. And this one, there's so much that I've kept because it's changed my energy level so much. So I'm not probably going to be a gym rat for the rest of my life. But I loved incorporating exercise into my life in every nook and cranny. So I take the stairs. I do the treadmill desk. Sometimes I run errands. You know, I'll run to the drugstore, literally, and run buy toothpaste and run back.
You did pull together some tips from Mental Floss magazine. You mentioned the interval training, but don't stretch, skip heavy lifting, hydrate with beer. these are not quite intuitive.
No, well, hydrate with beer I would take with a grain of salt. That was just because the winner of the first marathon back in 1896, the first modern marathon, during the race, he stopped at a bar and had a glass of wine. Some say it was cognac. So that was sort of a nod to that. There's also, I think I talked about it in that one, there's a great tip. There's studies that show that if you take a sip of a sports drink and then spit it out instead of swallowing it, that will give you a boost of energy because your tongue senses the sugars in the sports drink, sends a message to the body, energy on the way, but then you spit it out, you don't get the calories. So I love that little trick.
AJ Jacobs, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
AJ Jacobs, journalist, author, and human guinea pig, we dare say. His newest book is Drop Dead Healthy, One Man's Humble Quest for Bodily Perfection. Now, you can find links to more on the book, including some reviews, and also to see a picture of our youthful producer, Taylor Quimby, advanced to age 70. Funny, the rest of us on the show declined. Earlier this week, senior producer Rebecca Lavoie followed the Twitter feed of Raw Story executive editor Megan Carpentier. Megan was at a New York City restaurant while next to her, a drama played out. She drew people in with this pithy tweet, edited for language. There is a schadenfreudic satisfaction in seeing a wealthy hipster couple argue about banal relationship stuff while one is eating alone. Carpentier then started a conspiratorial string of live tweets on this situation unfolding just a few tables over, while Rebecca and hundreds of others hung on to every word.
The date I'm watching is going so well that she paid and he's still holding out a 20 for her to take while she berates him, arms crossed. At me. Now they are both not looking at each other while she leans back in her chair, arms crossed. He put the 20 under her water glass. V is very, very extra. He pulled out more cash after doing the resigned head tilt. Damn traffic noise, I can't hear. Anyone that you adore can love. He just got up and stood in front of her seat until she, resigned, stood up and they left. They are now arguing on the corner outside. Just a game for two. We are in the full emphasis points with chin thrust mode here, and now she's staring catty corner rather than across the street. Don't break it, love. Whatever this bro did, I'm on her side, full disclosure. Ooh, the cheek kiss. He got a cheek kiss, attempted for her mouth, got pushed back, and they stalked off with his arm across her shoulders. She still had her arms crossed, though.
Thanks to our online editor, Courtney Kenya, for reading the tweets of Raw Stories' Megan Carpentier. And we'd love to hear what you think. As someone who's had her share of tiffs over dinner, it's a little mortifying to imagine having a witness tracking the action. For perspective, I turn to the anachronistic source of Jane Austen. For what do we live but to make sport of our neighbors and laugh at them in our own turn? We'd love to hear what you think as well. An innovative, voyeuristic use of Twitter? Or just another sign that these days you are always on candid camera? Send us a tweet with your take at Word of Mouth. And coming up, we're going to be hearing about the bloggess, her inappropriate life. That explains a lot when Word of Mouth continues. Love is more than just a game
for two. Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
For word of mouth.
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 From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Blogger Jenny Lawson called upon a few of her biggest fans to make the trailer for her new memoir. Let's pretend this never happened.
Hi, I'm Jenny Lawson.
Hi, I'm Jenny Larson. I mean Lawson.
No, actually, my name is Jenny Lawson.
Really?
Yes, really, actually. I've written a whole book about my life as a poverty-stricken, mentally unbalanced girl raised by my father, a taxidermist, in poverty-stricken, dangerously violent rural Texas.
Author Neil Gaiman there, along with his wife, musician Amanda Palmer, and the actors Will Wheaton and Jerry Ryan. All claiming to be Jenny Lawson in a YouTube video that's been viewed more than 70,000 times. Jenny Lawson is the writer behind The Bloggess, which, besides attracting famous fans, averages close to 1 million views a month. Some of her wryly funny posts, including one about the impulsive purchase of a giant metal chicken, have gone hyper-viral millions of times over. Jenny's new memoir traces her distinct, irreverent voice back to its source, a barely believable childhood in West Texas, without much running water, but no shortage of strange stories involving animals, both alive and dead. And she joins us now on the line. Jenny, great to have you on Word of Mouth.
It's so nice to be here. How are you?
I'm very well. And I found the book just so funny, gut-splittingly funny in many instances. Even from the beginning, you describe your childhood as David Copperfield meets Guns and Ammo magazine.
Exactly.
Now, I know you weren't made to work at a blacking factory. So what was David Copperfield meets Guns and Ammo for you?
I'm going to say, for the most part, we occasionally didn't have running water. And when we did have running water, the water was poisoned. So there's that. And, you know, we didn't have air conditioning and heating growing up. And heating wasn't so bad, but in Texas, no air conditioning was like almost the end of the world. Mm. We grew up pretty poor, although I have to say that, to my parents' credit, I really didn't realize just how poor we were. I really just thought, well, we don't need running water that won't kill you when you swallow it. That's not something you need. That's a luxury that you get when you become a millionaire.
There's so many stories in the book that you admit that most people don't believe. Your father was a taxidermist, and you tell a story about the time he brought a magical talking squirrel into your bedroom. Can you relay that for us?
Sure. Well, what happened was I was probably about 8 and my sister was about 5. And my father was always bringing home really bizarre things like porcupines in tires and baby bobcats and raccoons wearing clothes and things like that. And he came into our room in the middle of the night and he had a Ritz cracker box. And I was actually very happy that he woke me up for that because we never had brand name food in the house. So it was a nice, pleasant surprise. But then he opened it up, and instead there was a squirrel, which seemed anticlimactic for him. But then he told us that this was a magic squirrel, which we didn't buy at all, until he talked to the squirrel and would tell the squirrel what's 2 plus 3, and the squirrel would raise his tiny little squirrely paw 5 times and basically convinced us. And that was when I knew for sure that we were going to get out of this tiny little town. We were going to be rich. I was going to name this magical squirrel Stanley. We were going to have berets made for him and little vests, and he was going to be awesome. And it was right at that moment that my father ripped open the Ritz cracker box, and I noticed that Stanley's little stomach was distended in a really bizarre way and that his little back paws were hanging awfully limply, and that's when I realized that this squirrel was roadkill that my father had just cut open and made into a hand puppet.
But he gets an A for effort, doesn't he?
He does. Let me tell you, it was very realistic. It was bloody and horrific, and that was pretty much the beginning of the end for me, where I was like, oh, we're not normal. We are not a normal family.
Well, being not normal is something you embrace and sort of, I would say, communicate loudly in your blog. And that's probably, you know, what has made you so popular. I mean, people find you irreverent and so funny. And your husband, Victor, he plays the kind of role of foil of sorts. And you describe him as a square Republican, not always enthusiastic about your inspirations.
Exactly.
Well, how does Victor feel about becoming your foil for millions of people? He's become popular as you.
You know, I think it doesn't really bother him because for the most part, he doesn't really read the blog. He skimmed over the book. I mean, for the most part, it doesn't really affect him. The thing, though, that I think he is seeing that is different is that the people that he works with, they now read the blog. Mm. And so they know all of these inner jokes that only he assumed we knew, and so they would make these jokes. He would be like, how did you know that? It's like we have our house tapped. I mean, everybody knows everything. So.
And they probably know his real name.
They know Victor. Exactly.
Okay. We're talking with Jenny Lawson, known to millions of her fans on her blog and on Twitter as The Bloggess. She's written a new memoir called Let's Pretend This Never Happened, and she says it's a mostly true memoir.
Right.
You're so candid in the book and on your blog about what really is a crippling anxiety disorder, and you also suffer from depression. You've written about self-harm. Would you be the bloggess without these struggles? I mean, is reaching out online easier than going out and interacting in the real world for you?
I think it absolutely is. I think the internet has given me the opportunity to sort of meet people and get out there without actually having to leave my house. I am a bit of a hermit in real life. I'm a little bit agoraphobic. I have extreme anxiety disorder, which is making the book tour quite difficult, and I am very well medicated, thank God. But, you know, what's really great about the internet is that, first of all, it brings together so many people that are like me, who feel as if they were, you know, kind of misfits for their entire life and never really fit in. So when I shared that I do have anxiety disorder and panic attacks, I was amazed at, first of all, how many people were extremely supportive, but also how many people said, me too, and I've never said that before to anyone else, or, you know, my mom has it, or my child has it, and I thought she was the only one, and I was so embarrassed about it. And there's something very freeing and wonderful about being able to say, I have this issue and I own it completely. What also has been very nice is that if I'm having a panic attack, I can actually get on Twitter and say, I think I'm about to have a panic attack. I need somebody to tell me it's going to be okay. Can you talk me down from this? And people get on, and like 1,000 people saying, it's okay, this happened to me yesterday too, keep breathing, we're here for you. And suddenly you realize that you're not alone even when you are alone.
But it's interesting because you seem fearless in a way. I mean, your book is very poignant when you talk about carrying a baby to term, for example, after losing two, your mental illness, as we mentioned, and maybe most surprisingly, the level of affection that threads beneath your snarky stories about Victor. I wonder if this is a love letter to him of sorts.
It absolutely is. It's a love letter to my entire family. And my biggest hope with the book is that people can see that. The book itself is a humor book, and it's sort of a dark satire for, I always say, a dark satire for intellectual misfits. But at heart, it is a love story to my family and to my husband and my daughter to sort of thank them for all of those moments that we wanted to pretend never happened, those moments that actually made me who I am today.
Mostly true. Anything so crazy that you decided not to include it in the book?
So much. There were so many stories that were so fabulous, but I could not find photographic proof of them, and I just thought no one's going to believe them. And that's the reason why there are so many pictures in the book.
Yeah, you really presage the new media era by having pictorial records of
I absolutely did, because I was like, no one is going to believe this. Every time somebody says, but that's not true, it usually is not only extraordinarily true, but it usually was even worse than I explained it.
Well, a very entertaining read, just like the blog, and I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Jenny Lawson, the bloggess. She's a blogger, columnist, and now author of Let's Pretend This Never Happened, a mostly true memoir. There's much more in the book, including the book trailer that we mentioned, and also a link to our previous conversation with Jenny about that famous giant metal chicken, named Beyonce, by the way. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org. Sound familiar? Well, it should. It's a Star-Spangled Banner, sort of. The minor key version of the national anthem is just one of the things that our fellow listeners wrote to us about recently, and senior producer Rebecca Lavoie is here to talk about some of your questions and comments. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, Virginia.
So we used this version of the Star-Spangled Banner last week, and I understand a listener was curious.
He was. This was actually a piece of music we used to bridge two segments together. One of them was a profile of painter John McNaughton, who's gotten some notoriety and a little bit of money for his paintings, which portray President Obama in, shall we say, a less than flattering light. We paired this with a cute segment by a 9-year-old reading her essay about the more practical side of becoming president. Mm-hmm. And this bridge inspired a listener named Jeffrey to send us an email. It always fascinates me how NPR programmers come up with appropriate or not snippets of music to accompany segments. How do you do it? Is there someone on the staff who has an encyclopedic memory for music, an instant recall of where it's located? This would be an interesting subject for its own segment.
Okay, here we are. For Jeffrey's sake, and for anyone else who might be curious, how did that piece of music end up on the show?
Well, I would love to say it was a product of our genius, but in actuality, it kind of went down the way it always does. I was working on the segment alone, and I thought, you know, it would be awesome? A patriotic song in a minor key. So I went to YouTube and typed in patriotic song in a minor key, and voila, I found a veritable treasure trove of just such music. The song we just heard was called America the Ugly, and it was uploaded by a YouTuber named General Kavakos. I chose it because it sounded dark, it was pretty obvious, and the thing that I really found that was interesting is that there were so many other familiar songs in minor keys, like this one. Tell me if you recognize it.
Oh no, it's Happy Birthday.
It is.
That's so sad.
It is
sad birthday.
Happy sad pan flute birthday. That is a minor key version of Happy Birthday uploaded by a YouTuber named Coyote Tito 654. Now, of course, as a radio producer, I'm already thinking, what would I use this song for?
Maybe an interview with someone seriously depressed about getting older.
Maybe, or maybe an interview about someone who just got really, really bad news on their birthday.
So YouTube, that's just one of the many sources in your trick bag, right?
It is only one of many sources. That's exactly right. Actually, a lot of the music we use is recommended by listeners. Taylor and I will put out calls on our personal Facebook pages to our friends to say, you know, what music do you like? But we do spend some time in between producing segments to find interesting music. They're actually called beds, as you know, when they're under you talking, or artists we haven't yet discovered. For this show, we mostly use instrumental, mostly contemporary music. If there's a tech segment, for example, we might find something with a mechanical sound. sound. If we're doing something about farming, we might try to find something with banjos or that sounds a little bit earthy. But one of our favorite things to do is to do what we did with the Star Spangled Banner, and that's to find some familiar song with a twist. Our colleague Taylor, for example, found this piece of music to accompany a story we did about children's author Tom Engelberger, who writes a series of books about an origami Yoda.
I remember when he found that. We were so excited. It's both Star Wars and origami-ish.
That's right, and that's exactly the criteria. Although sometimes it's also about atmosphere. If a story is about a place, for example, we'll try and find music that fits the place, like this piece that Taylor also found for a segment we did about malls.
And with that deadening mall music in the background, it is gratifying to know that people are actively and carefully listening. Rebecca, thanks for a peek behind the curtain at producing Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much.
Word of Mouth senior producer Rebecca Lavoie is at the receiving end of your email, Facebook posts, tweets, and of course, your letters. There are several ways to reach us with your feedback and your ideas for segments or comments on what you've heard. You'll find them all at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, all beat, all the time. So Percussion joins us when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. So Percussion finds the music in tin cans, chalkboards, toy pianos, ringtones, and mallets. We're listening to their performance of music from the Mallet Quartet by minimalist composer Steve Reich. And two members of the group are joining us right now. Adam Slewinski and Eric Beach are with us. Hello, Adam.
Hey.
Hi, Eric.
Hi, how's it going?
Just fine. Great to have you back on Word of Mouth. And of course, we give props to the two other members of the band, Josh Quillen and Jason Truding. I kind of imagine you guys, you know, driving around, doing rehearsals, just drumming on things all the time. Is it really like that?
Kind of, but you can actually get pretty sick of each other if it's just that a lot. I think maybe when we were younger, it was a little more drumming on everything. I think now it's a little more sort of a lot of listening to what's around us. We've been doing a lot of John Cage-inspired stuff this year, and I think that's been having us all kind of walking around, just listening to a whole bunch of different stuff around us.
Yeah, I read a review of your performance at the John Cage Centennial. This was last month at Zankel Hall in New York City. Now, I also read that you encourage people to turn up their ringtones. Did you work them into the performance?
Yeah, that particular instruction was part of a piece that this guy Dan Deacon composed that we played as part of the concert. And he had a whole list of instructions for the audience, one of which was to set an alarm on your phone. But there was a lot of people switching seats with each other and trying to play music on their phones and making different sounds, whooshing sounds with their voices and stuff like that.
Did it work?
Totally.
Oh, man, it was totally awesome.
It was awesome.
Well, it must be a bit of a crapshoot on something like that. I mean, you must have to react fairly quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, with all of this Cage stuff, we've been trying really hard to honor the experimental spirit of what Cage did. And John Cage used to define an experimental piece or an experimental process as one in which the outcome is not completely decided or not sure. And so every time we were doing a piece with the audience or something like that, it totally depends on the night, the crowd, all kinds of things. But we thought that was a really fun way to honor what he was all about.
Well, you know, apropos of that, there is also a very, very funny photo of all of you hunched over on stage over a cactus.
In the New York Times, no less.
Yeah. Oh, we like our cactuses.
What were you doing?
Yeah, we were playing that piece with this group, Matmos, an electronic duo based out of Baltimore. And we released a whole album with them. Each piece on the album is made out of different materials. So there's one that's all aluminum. There's one that's all ceramics. There's one that has a lot of sounds from water. And that one is all sounds from a cactus. So when we do it live, we play a live cactus and we get as many sounds as we can out of that. And then Martin and Drew from Matmos are doing some manipulation in real time and playing back some pre-recorded from our dearly departed first cactus, Murray.
He didn't make it.
What happened to Murray, Eric?
Well, there's some speculation that Murray might have been murdered cacticide.
He might have been overwatered, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I'd love to hear one of the tracks because, you know, it's just too sad to go down the Murray, this Murray story. the experimental electronic outfit Matmos that you worked with, here's one of the tracks from the album written by So Percussion, and this is Water from the album Treasure State. That's Water, written by So Percussion, from a collaboration with the electronic outfit Matmos. Tell me a little bit about that. You know, someone must have been playing water, banging water drum.
Yeah, well, and let me first give a quick shout out to the trumpet that you hear on that track is the fantastic jazz trumpeter Dave Douglas.
Oh, is it?
Who came in for that session on that track. And then we've since, last year, we made a whole record with Dave Douglas on his label Greenleaf. So that was kind of fun to hear him on there as well. But yeah, for that piece, that I believe is Martin Schmidt from Matmos playing the water in the bucket. And that was a cool moment to come into the piece, actually, when we drop everything out and he just splashes around a little bit and then kind of everything else comes in. Yeah, I mean, I think in the Cajun spirit, you know, the sound of water is can be a lovely sound, so why not incorporate it in some way?
I'm wondering about collaborations like this. Adam, you've been with the group the longest, almost 10 years. Yeah. Now there's so much remixing, you know, electronica, experimental music being made. Has interest in percussion ensembles grown in that time?
I think so. I mean, it certainly has in the last 100 years when it was more or less invented in Western music. But in the last 10 years, even, yeah, since I've been doing this with So, it's been really cool and interesting to see how much the culture has opened up to so many different ideas. And in our world, the sort of contemporary classical world, I can really credit groups like the Kronos Quartet, even though they're not percussionists, or Bang on a Can, some of these groups that a couple decades ago or a few decades ago, they were really pushing for this idea that, hey, you know, we can all get along with a bunch of different influences and ideas and coming from different places. And I think just in our time, we just took that inspiration and ran with it. And it's been really fun.
Well, let's hear a little bit more of what you do. And this is a selection from It Is Time Part 1, Metronome. Now, this is composed by Steve Mackey and performed by So Percussion. That's So Percussion performing a piece by Steve Mackey. Eric Slewinski and Eric Beach from So Percussion are with me. Anything that you want to tell me about that piece? There's so many different elements at the same time.
Steve kind of wanted to write for whatever each of us wanted to play. And for the other guys, Josh is an amazing steel pan player, Jason's an amazing drum set player, and Adam's an amazing Roomba player. So it was just natural for all of them. And I was like, man, I don't know exactly what I want Steve to write for. So I went through this long process of sending crazy sounds to Steve and him picking out things. And, you know, I sent him this analog metronome. I was just imagining things, you know, like the metronome could be going in the background or stuff like that. And then he sent back this idea of this digital delay on the metronome. And we've spent hours trying to get these analog metronomes set perfectly straight so that when the digital delay is happening, you get exactly the right rhythm that that part of the movement is based on. Mm. But also there's a bunch of kind of like bells, no bells, an SD organ.
I'm just wondering if either of you ever, you know, just want to pound out a glam rock drum solo, you know, lay down a 4-4 beat. Is that
it's happened. Absolutely. It's happened. And in some of our work with Matmos, you know, they use a lot more references to pop music and their own music than we do. And so, because, you know, we all went to like, you know, very wonderful, but like classical music conservatory. So it's hard for us to break something like that out sometimes, but they were so unashamed of it that when we work with them, we get to do it sometimes.
Well, Adam Sawinski, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
And Eric Beach, thank you too.
Yeah, thank you.
Adam Sawinski and Eric Beach are half of the group So Percussion. Josh Quillen and Jason Truding fill out the quartet. Thanks for spending some time with us today on Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, inviting you to join us again next week for Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Virginia Prescott,
and senior producer Rebecca Lavoie, with oversight and direction
from Abby Goldstein, NHPR's Vice President of Programming,
and web support from Brady Carlson,
and Courtney Kenya.
Andrew Perella gives technical support,
and Dan Colgan. Dan, the man, runs our board.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individual,
not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters.
Really, anybody else.
For information about the show, to listen to past segments, post a comment, or read our blog,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
Or use the On Demand tab on the NHPR app.
You can join our community of listeners on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
And you can follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.